Fact it is. Okay. Welcome, everybody. Tonight's class is Howard Stern's Choice. Now, of course, you innocent people don't even know who Howard Stern is. Who is this individual? Okay. So, Howard Stern, for those uninitiated, was quintessentially for decades America's shock jock, who, his whole point of his radio show now on XM, whatever you call that, satellite radio. Thank you, satellite radio. Where basically for 3 hours he will say inflammatory things, graphic things, and I would argue appropriate things. And then he's been an icon. But our goal here is not to explore his career, but rather his epiphany. He had an epiphany. Okay, so we're gonna go to, shall we say, let's go to the videotape. Okay. Okay. Tell me if you guys can hear it and we'll see it. Okay.
Okay. Boris, I'm the father.
Hold on 1 second.
Think about his personal evolution.
Okay, 1 second. I need to.
In recent years, sparked by some intensive therapy.
They can hear, but then it's always a struggle. I'm, 1 second. Yeah, same annoying thing. There we go.
For my interview with Howard Stern, his new book is out this morning, and we spoke about his personal evolution in recent years, sparked by some intensive therapy. What was the...
Back again.
For my interview with Howard Stern, his new book is out this morning, and we spoke about his personal evolution in recent years, sparked by some intensive therapy. What was the first thing that got you in?
I was going through a divorce. I'm the father to 3 daughters. I didn't know. I was scared out of my mind. I had been married most of my life. How am I going to have a successful relationship with any woman, or man for that matter, if I don't know what's up and what's down? And when I got into therapy, I had to start learning how to be a man. I didn't have any lessons. I didn't really have that level of communication with my own father.
So you're learning how to become a man. When does it start to become apparent in your interviews?
I had never really been alone in a room with a man where he heard me and listened to me. And I describe in the book that when the first session I went in, I'm sitting there and I'm telling him stories about my parents because I'd never been to a psychiatrist. I needed a psychiatrist. I have it all together. I sit down and I'm doing some of the best radio routines I've ever done. I'm doing impressions of my mother. I'm doing impressions of my father.
You're going to be the best patient.
Best patient because I got to be loved. And he turned to me and he goes, none of this is funny. And I was like, well, hey, I do this for a living. And he goes, no. He goes, why don't you get real with me? Some of what you're telling me sounds very sad, and yet you're laughing at it. Well, this was mind-blowing to me. No one had ever said that to me, and I had never had a real conversation like that before. And as the years went by, I got more and more turned on by being listened to.
You're being heard, but you're also shining more of a light on the people you're talking to.
Going to SiriusXM and having 4 hours to do whatever I wanted and not have to worry about, you know, the size of the audience.
Forget about those 3 people not listening to you.
That's right. Just let go of that. And that's also something I had to work on in therapy. So when I'm sitting there, I said, what would it be like to really hear what someone has to say? And it has led to some incredible conversation.
It's great that he's gotten help and he's, you know, a softer, gentler Howard. Has he apologized, though, to some?
He says he has reached out to some, mm-hmm. And he clearly says that he's embarrassed by a lot of the things he's done in the past, and he's stopped doing some, not all, some of the more outrageous things on camera. Okay. We have an extended...
All right. much. You guys hear that? And you guys were able to hear the video? Good. Okay, so you guys heard. Okay. All right. You guys, am I coming through clear? You guys hear me clearly? All right, great. All right, let's go to a share screen over here. Okay. All right. What poor choices caused Howard Stern's meltdown?
Disease, like nobody ever listened to me, and I'm like, what about his wife? Did she never listen to him? I mean, that's just one incidental thing.
So I don't know. So, well, he starts the conversation saying he's in the middle of a divorce. So he was married to his high school sweetheart. They had three children, and then I don't know. I guess I don't know how she quite tolerated him for this long, but whatever she decided, like, okay, I do better. Whatever the I don't know what their, you know, I didn't buy the book to read all the gory details, this side, obviously. What was the problem that he was struggling with? Or people go to therapy when what happens in their life? And no, people, bad things happen to people all the time. They don't go to therapy. Not true.
They don't know. They want to make.
Typically, when they start to not be able to function, most people do not. There are a few enlightened people that will go before that. Typically, they start to go to therapy when my life is swirling into oblivion and I can't function properly. That's, you know, where the people in their life have an intervention and insist like you're not realizing that you're sorry. So what problem was he facing? He was facing a tremendous problem. He had a major problem. He has three kids, and he, you know, without his wife's assistance, he's now having to be a good father to them, and he started to become very clear that he's failing. The failure was starting to become palpable, and he had the presence of mind and the good fortune, and got to give the guy credit. He went to therapy, didn't recognize that he got a major problem. He had no idea what the problems were. When he described his first session with the therapist, what did he do?
He put the
therapist on the show. The show, in other words, he was like, he made it like, as you know, he's the interviewer. And he's and he says, it was some of the best radio I ever did. Making, you know, impressions of his parents, you know. And the therapist says, you know, what are you doing? And he said, it may be funny in a sad sort of way, but the events that you're depicting show tremendous dysfunction. And then he basically said that basically it came out that he really had a very thin or non-existing or dysfunctional, whatever word you want to use, of his father. He never even spoke to his father didn't have a real substantive relationship with his father. And that, he doesn't go into the whole thing right there. But, and then as he says, therefore he didn't know how to be essentially what it is to be an adult and be a father. You didn't know. Basically, you learn how to be a parent from your parents. So if your parents are dysfunctional, you've been taught poorly, and therefore you have to go through a process of relearning. You know what I'm saying? You're going to the errors or the issues that you have absorbed from the observance of your parent relationship are going to be transferred to your next relationship. So if your parents are self-aware and self-actualized and have tremendous emotional intelligence and work in a chesedic way, you are way ahead of the game. If it's not, you carry luggage and you carry these issues to the next relationship, and requires a conscious relearning, typically through therapy, to not, you know, bring the same problems that your parents had to the next relationship. Does that resonate to be true? Do you think that's does that make sense before I go on?
Not being like have, you know, think or argue or whatever in a certain way. When you see that, when you see how they interact with you, and you're like, I don't want to do that.
Correct. So people, so one approach is just to go like the George Costanza opposite approach, you know, whatever you're doing, I'm going to do the opposite, you know, very confrontational, completely always the peacekeeper and never talk about any issues, or confrontive if it was a very, you know, saying, then become what they call in psychology a reaction formation. In other words, if they were this extreme, I'm going to go to the other extreme because I didn't like the consequence of that. But that's actually not a very good strategy either, because no one strategy is effective for every circumstance. So, you know, being the peacemaker is helpful sometimes. Being confrontational can be helpful sometimes, but you can't have the same. You can't just have one tool in your drawer. That's not gonna work for you. That's not really it's just you're just reacting. My parents were, you know, troubled. I'm gonna do the opposite, but that brings other troubles. So that's not necessarily a measure of self-awareness per se, Harry.
In other cases where people pick on priests with sugar, is it that their biological parent or more their upbringing by their parent they raised by that affects them?
So that of course is an ancient question of nature versus nurture. I'm not going to weigh in on that large thing, but my intuition is that the environment probably plays a more significant role, though your genetics plays a fantastically significant role as well. So I don't. That's a question of endless debate. I'm not really equipped to answer that, Shiloh. I'm going to say likely, I think what the consensus is in our day is that the environment will play a outsized role. Yeah. Again. Okay. So question three, what different choices might Stern have made if his father had gotten him help earlier as a young person? In other words, he had to wait till he was 40 after he had a two near three decade plus challenge relationship with three kids. Then the epiphany, like, I don't know how to be a father. That is a little late in the game. You don't want to realize I have adult children. I really recognize that I have some sense, you know, better late than never. Give credit. But imagine his father would have either A, had a therapist or not necessarily or a coach, whatever the person, the expert opinion they had, and helped them have a better, more communicative, healthy relationship in his childhood. Now, part of it was obviously there was a certain situation. Obviously, life in the 60s and early 70s was not, you know, these were newer concepts. So, you know, we're not saying it could have been, but imagine if it did happen, how would his life be different? Why still be married? Right? And maybe he wouldn't have to, you know, maybe some, you know, his career choice didn't have to be somebody whose whole approach is I need to get, he says, part of his, you know, his, assuming that he is correct about his self-assessment, a motivating factor for him is the continuous need to get love and approval from typically strangers, his audiences. And by doing things which are, you know, extremely provocative. So his whole thing is to think of what is the most provocative to get a rise out of people. And for the millions of, adult adolescent men that resonate to his humor. So he just wants them to entertain them, you know, he made a career out of that. So he may not have been that person. He could have had a much more, he may have not been the Howard Stern that we have, but he may have been a happier person. Question four, what educational focus underlies Howard being taught how to read and write and do math? What is he assuming? He got an education. What is the educational focus? What is raising a kid in our society essentially about? To read and write and do math. What is something that everybody agrees upon? In order to raise a kid, they must be, literate. And what is it really instrumental of? have a, that's it, basically, to be a productive member of the workforce, which is important. It's a mitzvah of the father to make sure, the parents, to make sure the child can support themselves. Very, very important. What is missing? Why would this educational focus neglect emotional education?
I mean, it would also imply that the you're turning to the state for an emotional, ethical education. It's not necessarily where.
So, okay, so you could argue is that the, but even if I'm not saying, I'm not, without having to, using the vernacular, Max, to say that we want to have the nanny state to do it, but how come it's not even an ego ideal of our society that just as the child is trained to have, you know, basic educational competencies, it's not seen to be a thing to have emotional competencies. When is there an intervention? So when I used to be a principal, when does the child get an intervention?
When something breaks.
He or she is not functioning. Where they're acting out in class. Oh, now we're going to bring in a therapist. Oh, well, when their behavior is outside the norm. But why are we doing it only when there's we're only gonna deal with health and wellness when the person is sick. Right. This is the classic Western model. The Eastern model is our goal is to promote health. And then when the person is ill, well, you'll deal with that as well. But the main thing is to focus on healthy living and Judaism is also harmonious living. And therefore, you have a psyche. If you're going to ignore that, I have really no education. Now, obviously, a parent is in charge, but you see that many parents, as he said, is it Howard's fault? No. Is his dad's fault? No, because each one is, in a certain sense, a kind of a victim. They didn't know that's even a thing. You just do. There's no training at all. So that's something which is as you engage with your family, question number six. How does the current neglect of emotional education promote poor choice like Howard Stern's father made? So he had this relationship with his dad and he couldn't speak to him really about anything of substance. And then he was this kind of guy who couldn't talk to anybody.
To his audience.
Interesting. He can talk to everybody, but not his in a certain sense, not even to himself in a certain sense, and not to his family in any kind of real way. He can be engaging. In other words, that's important. In other words, it's you would imagine, isn't that kind of weird? He's like the Mr. Interviewer guy, but he's saying he never listened to anybody. What does it mean to listen to somebody? In other words, what does it mean? How can he do 3 hours of, who can explain the following? How is this guy able to have 30 years of talk radio, 3 hours a day for 5 days a week, and he says, I've never listened to anybody. What does he mean by that?
Internalizing it, he's always thinking about what he's going to say next.
Exactly right. In other words, he's listening to the person in the extent that he can then jump off to find that witty comment, you know, so he can, or he's never listened to her, nor is they are a springboard for him to say the next funny, witty, provocative, cool thing. But he has no sense of the person. He's not listening to the person. To do serious listening is a very intense, emotionally, I would even call it in a certain sense, kind of spiritual experience. I can't describe it any way more than that. You know what I'm saying? If I'm talking to an MG about something in their life and I'm just listening, so I feel like I'm bearing with them their situation. You know what I'm saying? It's not like I'm not saying a word or very little, but I feel like I'm with them feeling the burden of their experience. I'm not saying anything. I'm not having a good idea necessarily because we may not have a good idea, but I'm trying to, if I'm good at listening, I'm with the person, sensing them. I'm going to use a kind of, I'm struggling here, but sort of like on an existential level. You know, you know what I'm talking about? I'm not able to give it even words. Yeah, but it, not as like, if you're really listening to somebody, you are literally, will simultaneously emotionally feeling first person with them. You are sort of like with the eye with them, while simultaneously you are you to reflect upon them. You're going back, you're actually inhabiting them in a certain sense, while simultaneously being your own self and sensing their circumstance. That's really an empathy. And also, better yet, sympathy, like understanding it without being emotionally colored by the situation. So you want to make more of a sympathy is understanding and not necessarily being. It's also, but sometimes getting empathy where you're actually drawn into the, you in the emotional, you're in their emotional world. You know what I'm saying? So that's what he's talking about. He never did that. Therefore, he had no real relationship with anybody because he never listened to anybody. He was always thinking of the cute liner he's going to say. And he was fun. He is funny. He did not have 30 years of success without him being a talented person. He was very good about that. Okay. With this introduction, obviously, what does it got to do with our journey of Judaism? So last week we talked about, our focusing is building out. We talked about Tzelem Elokim, the divine image, free will. We're now going to build upon us with a statement of Talmud. All right, Max, since everybody can hear you and the people here can hear you, they can't hear, you can't hear them. So, Bavakasha, read this Gemara in Baba Basra.
Baba Basra 21a, as Rav Yehuda says, that Rav says, truly that man is remembered for the good, and his name is Yeshua ben Gamla. If not for him, the Torah would have been forgotten from the Jewish people. Initially, whoever had a father would have his father teach him Torah, and whoever did not have a father would not learn Torah at all. The Gemara explains, what verse did they interpret homiletically that allowed them to conduct themselves in this manner? They interpreted the verse, and you shall teach them, otam, to your sons, to mean, and you yourself, atem, shall teach, i.e., your father shall teach your sons.
Stop right there. So Jewish education pre-Second Temple was homeschooling. Dad gave basic Jewish education to their kid. One problem was that if the kid did not have a dad or the kid's father was unable to do that, the kid became Jewishly illiterate, other than what he saw. Keep on going.
When the sages saw that not everyone was capable of teaching their children and Torah studying was declining, they instituted an ordinance that teachers of children should be established in Jerusalem. The Gemara explains, what verse did they interpret homiletically that enabled them to do this? They interpreted the verse, for Torah emerges from Zion. But still, whoever had a father, his father ascended with him to Jerusalem and had him taught. But whoever did not have a father, he did not ascend and learn.
So therefore, they created an educational center, sort of a master elementary school. The problem is it didn't solve the problem because the kids who didn't have a father had nobody to ensure that they actually went to the school. Okay. That was not helpful. Okay.
Same principle challenges now, right?
Yeah, doesn't it? Okay.
Yeah. Therefore, the sages instituted an ordinance that teachers of children should be established in one city in each and every region, Pelech. And they brought their students in at the age of 16 and at the age of 17. But as these students were old and had not yet had any formal education, a student whose teacher grew angry at him would rebel against him and leave. It was impossible to hold the youth there against their will.
They're still struggling about getting the educational system right. You see, that's something that every society struggles with today. That's Jake. Keep on going.
The state of affairs continued until Yeshua ben Gamla came and instituted an ordinance that teachers of children should be established in each and every province and in each and every town, and they would bring the children in to learn at the ages of 6 and at the age of 7.
Excellent. Okay, so a couple questions. Question 7. In what way is the father's inability to step up and educate their children similar to Howard Stern's father's inability? And also, I'm very curious,
some level, it's like similar that you can't teach something that you don't master, right? It's not a math teacher, you're trying to teach math, is pointless. If your daughter is not well versed in Torah study, then it's going to be difficult for him to teach anything to his son. Impossible. And similarly to Howard Stern's parents, if they have a dysfunctional, relationship, then they can't teach them what a good relationship looks like.
Exactly correct. Barry?
Learning Torah is like not just about being literate, like the other one was mentioning, emotional connection.
Emotional education, right?
It's not about being literate. Learning Torah and teaching Torah to the kid is about giving them closer to the emotional, I would say, because it teaches you how to live your life morally and according to Jewish, just like halacha and everything, encompassing. And it's also, I feel like, it's considered an important part of father teaching.
It's a prime directive.
Yeah.
It's a prime directive.
Like emotional, whatever the word was.
Emotional education.
Education, they're both probably considered important.
Correct. So Torah is not simply a subject. There is, of course, instructional competencies, but it's a holistic outlook. So as Diane points out, that if your father is either your father is unable or you don't have a father, it's going to be the same outcome. You're going to have a child who's going to become an adult who's going to be like Howard Stern, having a massive deficit in their life, either emotionally or from a Torah perspective. And that's something which is you can't very easily remedy. Okay. 8, in what way was society's inability to step in and remedy the educational situation similar to our society failing to supply Howard Stern with emotional education? Right, so they tried all these different things. Obviously, in retrospect, wouldn't it be obvious to do that? Apparently, if you have a system that's been going, in other words, to change these foundational systems, are not simple. So if it was basically homeschooled and few people, and if you hit a certain level, you went to the local Beit Midrash and learned with other adults. But if you do not have the ability to walk in there, it's game over. There's a deficit. There's no mechanism to fix that. So they tried all different kinds of ways. Then, how many people that you know in your sphere of friends clearly have emotional deficits that they struggle with? They are carrying baggage, and there were things that were not offered to them as a child that they are now having to, they are shackled as adults, and that their struggle with limiting beliefs, and they can't free themselves today, whether it be expressed that they have, drug or alcohol issues, or you see that they're, they struggle with relationships, whatever it may be. But it's the same phenomena.
Some of us are that friend.
Not in this classroom, Max. I'm protecting the innocent here, Max. In what way was Yeshua ben Gamla the father of all Israel? He's really the father of all Israel. Why would that be an apt way of describing him?
Process, something that kept going throughout the generations. If he hadn't done that, who knows if somebody else would have the same kind of reform.
Correct. So he's being literally a father to children that they have a father who's competent, who has a father who does not have the skill set, or to children who have no father. He basically created a system, we call it what we call an elementary school now, which allowed the children. He tragically died year 70 from an internal civil war because he was against the zealots that were opposing the Romans. So he got killed from, I believe, Jews. But still, okay, that's a separate conversation. But his innovation lives to this very day, 2,000 years. And he's the father because basically he created, ensured that, as we say in Shema, Vishinam to Levanecha, you shall teach diligently to your son or to your children. He ensured that this gap of not, apparently there was a time in Jewish history where parents were able, were more adept to do that. Then there came a point during the second period of time where things were falling apart. Jews were divided into schisms. It was not a good time for the Jewish people. So let's go to question 10. In what sense was Avram the father of all humanity? So how does it make him their father?
Definitionally.
Okay, so how so?
Me?
Yeah, Max. And we'll go to your
Avraham. Being a smart ass, don't really pay attention to me.
Okay. Now you're on.
The father is the one that provides education, provided education of source of the education in a way. Weird circular logic.
Yeah, Yaron says it just for people who are on the Zoom call. Yaron point out is if the father is the you know, father is not limited to just father, but parent, but the father is providing the education that actually is giving birth to the child. In other words, Rashi says, "Shinant levanecha, you'll teach your sons diligently. Elu tamidecha, those are your students." So, in a certain sense, the educator really gives birth to the intellectual, to the spiritual component of the child. Whoever, as the Talmud says, whoever teaches somebody, you know, whoever is an exclusive parateacher of a person, as if they gave birth to them. In other words, because they are bringing into being the person's soul, if you will. That's why the honor given to the exclusive parateacher to a person is equal to the parent. The parent brought you into physical existence, and they bring you into a spiritual or metaphysical existence. So therefore, Yoshua ben Gamla is the father of Israel, and Avram is the father of humanity because he gave them the reality of that there's a source to the universe, and there's an ethical way to live. We call it ethical monotheism. Fancy word. Fancy word tonight. Was Avram Yoshua ben Gamla's father? That's true, but we can even go a little deeper than that. What's the relation between Avram and Yoshua ben Gamla? Well, I don't mean biologically, as far as he can be traced to him, which is probably true. Maybe there's a conversion. No.
I mean, they actually were fathers in a very similar sense that both of them largely have educational or almost proselytizing programs.
Right. So, but Gabriel said the same thing. So, okay. You can't hear. The problem is I can't hear. You can't hear what's going on here. So that's correct. Basically, they're both people that are unique. See, most people all people are focused on themselves, which is good because if nobody takes care of them, then they can at least take care of themselves. But they also have to take care of more people, at least many people are concerned about their family and then some to their friend. But their limit is that immediate circle, wherever you're going to put that sphere of circle. Avram, because of his love of God, and Yoshua ben Gamla, because of his love of God, are concerned about the Jewish people, or Avram even more, humanity. So it's a difference. It's a person who's thinking in a completely different paradigm. In other words, one thing is to see a problem. One is to even be allow yourself to be open to consider to deal with that structural problem. You know what I'm saying? Most people are dealing with the problems of their life, like, okay, when are we going to do shopping? When are we going to do cooking? When are we going to do laundry? And when am I going to go on vacation? And those are problems. They're legitimate, but their problems have a very limited micro perspective. Avram thing is like, how can I be able to bring out the idea about Hashem to humanity? Period, full stop. Without feeling personally like, and if I don't, you know, I got to do what I got to do. But it's a different kind of mindset. That's why he's a father of a civilization. Yeshua ben Gamla, as the Gemara starts off, says, he said, Rav said, truly the man remember for good, his name is Yeshua ben Gamla, but without him, Torah been forgotten for the Jewish people. That's a paradigm maker. It's not just like, he didn't just make simply a nice educational innovation. He's a game changer. I mean, that's it. It's nothing so part of our senior fellowship curriculum is that every class we're going to introduce to a major figure in Jewish history, Yeshua ben Gamla, critical. So much so that in Israel, there are called the Gamla school systems. His name is preserved in many schools because he's such a, he was a cutting edge educator. Okay, now, here's a key question of the thing, which connects us back all the way to our other previous classes. In what way is every person's choice dependent on their biological father and Torah father? This is the main question of tonight, in a certain sense. Well, I'm going to move it down for the question 11 for those who aren't. Now,
our choices from the knowledge that we have, and without our biological fathers teaching us those emotional things, and without our Torah fathers teaching us the lessons of right and wrong, we really wouldn't be able to make choices. So the lack of those informs our choices, and the knowledge of those informs our choices.
Exactly correct. Because a free will decision, just to build upon that, a free will decision is, it's the way you're going to transcend your nature and your nurture to the extent that man can, is going to get to be able to have clarity on, the two options of the moral choice. Free will is not ever, just a question. Let me just back up for a moment here. We didn't spend some time on a free will question. You go to a restaurant and you open up the menu and it says chicken and beef and there's a fish. Are you involved in free will at that point? So it seems from Maimonides and others, that's not the arena of free will. That really is going to be a function of the collision of nature versus nurture. Are you in certain moods? Are you in a chicken kind of mood? Are you in a steak kind of mood? Are you in a fish kind of mood? And it's like what really emotion is going to be dominant? If you see that in the Torah, Moshe talks about uvacharta b'chayim, ra, Tov, Chaim, Mavis. In other words, he's talking about pathways of life. Now, within the path of life, there are micro choices, but fundamental, it's big moral choices is the free will. Because you have one choice, which of course included in that, for example, a major Bechira choice that confronts everybody is where, when you get married, what community to pick? Major Bechira. Why is that? Because where you're going to marry, what synagogue you're going to connect to, is what can be the school option, which is how you're raising your kids, and who can be the environment for your kids. So basically, it's one choice, which really is going to be the destiny of your family. I don't want to make it pressurized, but I don't make it pressurized. Or if I pick an environment which is, cheap housing, gorgeous environment, but Jewishly poor in resources, is a decision, which was a decision basically of Lot. He looked out into the verdant, Jordanian thing with all the pasture land, which was well robust for his cattle. So he was looking about the money opportunity. It was not considered about he's leaving Avram, which is like hard to even imagine, and going to Sodom. So that was a Bechira decision. He wanted to have the money and the power because he walked in there. He was already a judge. He was a significant guy. So he went for the power and the money and the company, the good living, and he left living with Avram. That was a bad choice, retrospectively. So he got nearly killed twice, but he never went back. That's a separate, complicated guy load. My point being is that your bechira capacity is going to be in direct portion of who are your fathers. Who's your daddy? Like that means. Okay. I had to throw that little one in there. Yeah, wrong question. No. You seem puzzled. You seem whatever. Okay. You don't have to get a question. I'm just saying. You got a question on your face.
Life consequences of a certain scale.
No, it's not limited. They're moral choices. They're in other words where it's a calculation of Ra versus Toh, in other words, the way that Moshe talks about it in the Book of Devarim. B'charta b'chayim, you'll choose life. The toe versus the raw. So it could be micro, it could be very simply. It's like, a person could be in a 7-Eleven and they just really want that candy bar, and they, whatever reason, left their wallet at home and they just want the candy bar now. And on a very micro level, questions, and they can, and they see that the guy is distracted and they could pick that candy bar and just drop it into their pocket. And the guy will be none the wiser. And they'll just chalk it up as shrinkage. Everybody knows every retail store has shrinkage, 3% at least. So this is part of 3%. You're already rationalizing, so you can rationalize it away. So that's a moral question. But then he's thinking about then, yeah, I could have the candy bar, but what have I become? It could be. I'm just saying, we can create a bechira. I want to share that most people say, like, everything's a free choice. No, it's not true. Most of the things are determined in your life. Free will does not mean, very important, Jesus, but you have free will, but it doesn't mean that everybody's exercising free will, because, as your wife pointed out, you need to have an education to do that. If you're not educated, you're going to be just lost. You're going to be the leaf going through down the stream. You're sort of lost in your emotional world. You're not really able to consciously lift your head out of the stream and say, hey, what's going on here, and make real thoughtful assessments. Bechira has to come from a thoughtful assessment, judging the joy and the loss of each choice. In other words, the candy bar is delightful, delicious. I want it. But I'm living a life as a thief. Is that what I want my life to be about? Does this person deserve to have their personal rights violated? Why do I feel more entitled than this person to have this candy bar? It could be a small item, but it brings up the big issues about our morality. Like, who am I? What is good? What is rights?
I don't need to give
you
advice.
Nitpick. Good.
Okay, so if most people just kind of float through life, the vicissitudes of their desires, etc., does that mean that the realm of Bechira, as we've talked about, Ra versus Tov, I guess my question is, does Ra versus Tov exist independently of Torah?
Okay, so that gets into an ancient philosophical question, is does God mandate that which is good, or right, what God says is good? All right, so that's a whole, that'll take us down.
Because I'm saying that if your father didn't teach you Torah, then you would, according to that definition, like, rest through life without knowing that you're in a moral situation.
Right, correct. So a person who has no education is basically lost into their emotional world and is not really exercising their free will at all. They're basically an instinct. They're a two-legged instinct. It takes work to become able to be a person who could do free will. And that's why Rishu ben Gamla, that's why Avram, in other words, and that's why our instincts are so powerful, the only way you're going to be extracted is by having a father of the civilization in Avram, or sub-fathers like a Yeshua ben Gamla. I mean, I'm going to throw the question a little later on, but a question and scenario, just to just jump ahead, I'm going to go to scenario one, but I'm going to skip here. Scenario one, Steve Emgier was schmoozing with Nancy. He asked her, what would have happened to us if Rabbi Wiles did not start MGE? What do you think they would have said? If there was no MG. Okay, fine. That's not that's true. I'm not saying that they're not. I did not assert they're in a relationship. They're just whatever. Okay, fine. Okay. You guys are getting on the main points here. Okay. They're in a relationship. Let's make it simple. They're not dating. They just have to be two people within the MG community. Okay, let's just. What would happen without that?
Wait, then why aren't they dating?
Thank you, Max. They might be dating after their role in my scenario. They might go off in that alternate world in the metaverse, and they're dating. But that's not really the main point of the question. I'm arguing here in this scenario is that on a kind of a level, Rabbi Wild's decision in 1998 to not become a partner in a successful immigration firm and dedicate his life to create a community where people who did not have a Jewish background, education, or whatever, to have a place where they can find an accessible community. What happened was literally, there were 5,000 people a year historically gone through MG's doors per year. So times 22 years, it's a lot of people. So what would happen to these people? Because all their siblings, most siblings, when I do an MG wedding, one member of the family is intermarried and underneath the chuppah. I've even done weddings where the mother got remarried to a non-Jew and her second husband is underneath the chuppah. That's the norm. It is not the exception. A non-Orthodox person, 71% intermarriage rate. That's the norm. Basically, these literally tens of thousands of Jews, nearly close to 100,000 Jews, would not have the opportunity to. They could not on their own find this. Without these father characters, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Yeshua ben Gamla, and others creating these platforms for society portion of society to have an educational chance, people are not going to make it, not going to be able to have the education to be able to exert their free will. You know what I'm saying? That's why Avram's called Av Hamon Goyin. He's called the father of many nations. Because it's very few people that can be able to step out of the forces of their genetics and their environment and become what we call a self-made man. It's just not, It's not happening. So the way that Judaism works is that there are, these unbelievable figures that create the paradigm that the people can work within, that they can be lifted up. That's what the Torah essentially is. What is a Torah? It's a platform for non-Avrams to have a shot at having a real existence. That's essentially what the Torah is. Because we're not going to make it on our own. It's hard. It's just too hard. It is just too hard. The environment, the society. I mean, the fact that we're going to read about Avram, it's freaking amazing. That's why Ezekiel calls Avram, this is the line, Echad Haya Avram. Avram was essentially a singularity. Let's read about him, and let's read about Avram. All right, Max, you are on again. I'm going to scroll down. This is our last text of the night. Yeah, this is Avram. This is the Rambam depicting his narrative of Avram, age 40 onward. Go on.
Did you want me to read the Bereishis thing above it?
Okay, I'm sorry about that. It's based in part upon the verse. Let me take the verse. Go ahead.
Bereshit 21:33, he, Abraham, planted a tamarisk in Beersheba and called there in the name of Hashem, the eternal God. And then Rambam, Laws of Avodah Zarah 1:2. Abraham was 40 years old when he became aware of his creator. When he recognized and knew him, he began to formulate replies to the inhabitants of Ur Kasdim and debate with them, telling them that they were not following a proper path. He broke their idols and began to teach the people that it is fitting to serve only the God of the world. To him alone is it fitting to bow down, sacrifice, and offer libations, so that the people of future generations would recognize him. Conversely, it is fitting to destroy and break all the images, lest all the people err concerning them, like those people who thought that there are no other gods besides these images. When he overcame them through the strengths of his arguments, the king desired to kill him. He was saved through a miracle and left for Haran. There.
Stop right there. Why did the king in Ur, which is Mesopotamia, want to kill Avram? He's just having conversations, debates. Is he taking anything? He's not stealing anything. He's not breaking anything, I mean, except for the idol. But why does the king want to kill him?
By Abraham calling God the creator of the world, father of the world, he thinks he's a powerful king.
Dan is 1,000% correct. For the benefit of those on the Zoom, I will share what Dan said. Dan pointed out that by Abraham breaking down the false beliefs and systems of the king, which is the king and the religion were one. He's a semi-deity. And by him showing that basically that he pulls away the drapes and show that the emperor has no clothes. There's really nothing to this idolatry. He's basically undermined the entire system. There's nothing more powerful than an idea. And therefore now he's essentially, he's a enemy of the state. And therefore he has to become a fugitive. And what the Rambam now says, if it wasn't for, he was saved through a miracle and left for Haran. If it wasn't for a divine intervention, the Avram story would have stopped, would have ended before it even really started. So the Midrash makes that way that the king was Nimrod and he made a fiery furnace and he tossed him in there. What they did was, the story is in, they took the story from the book of Daniel, where King Nebuchadnezzar is making all the people bow to a 20-foot gold statue. Three of his abducted Jewish members of his civil service, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, says, we're not going to bow down. Even if we get killed, you're still wrong. And they were saved. They were able to get out of that. They were able to walk out unsinged. And so that idea of that standing up, even at the pain of death, to be willing to be martyred to the reality of the oneness of God, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, the Midrash basically took that idea and wrote it in Russian proper because it's the same concept. The Rambam says he doesn't bring that exact because it doesn't make a difference, but it's showing you the idea. It's making the Midrashim were cleverly created to take existing stories from the Tanakh and then be articulate to show a deeper concept. Avram is from the perspective of the king, an extremely dangerous person because he can take down a whole civilization. Is basically saying that what you guys believe in and which the king is manipulating with you is basically fraudulent. Okay, keep on going there, Max.
When he overcame, there he began to call out in a loud voice to all people and inform them that there is one God in the entire world. And it is proper to serve him. He would go out and call to the people, gathering them in city after city and country after country, until he came to the land of Canaan, proclaiming God's existence in the entire time, as Genesis 21:33 states, and he called there in the name of the Lord, the eternal God. When the people would gather around him and ask him about his statements, he would explain them to each one of them according to their understanding, until they turned to the path of the truth. Ultimately, thousands and myriads gathered around him. These are the men of the house of Abraham.
Well, Abraham was, first of all, was not only a great philosopher is what Ram depicts him, and a great revolutionary. He was also a great educator because he would speak to every person, whether the person's on a second grade level or a professor level. He was able to having the sophistication to be able to make that. Interestingly, that quality was also just for contemporary terms. That was really one of the elements of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik's greatness. He and his wife started the Maimonides School in Boston, and he would go in and teach second grade class. He would go in to just like teach class for a little bit and give them a Dvar Torah, which would be appropriate for a kid who's 8 years old. And simultaneously on his famous, he gave Parsha class every Saturday night in Boston for 40, 50 years. He had professors from Harvard and MIT coming to his class regularly who were not Orthodox. And he's able to convey this sophisticated manner, Judaism in a way that could speak to a person who were part of the leading intellectuals of America. That's a great gift. That's an Abrahamic level gift. Okay. So now, with all this in the package, so going back to scenario one with MJE, Rabbi Wilds acting in a kind of a Avram-esque way created a platform where people who never had the experience could be a user-friendly experience, which will give them a chance to have experience. Now, again, in a non-coercive thing, it's like MG is designed by design like a smorgasbord. You take the plate. They're different chafing dishes. You don't have to order everything. Take what you like, and that's it. You learn about it, and you make your decisions. You're an adult. Yeah, and you get to try out Judaism in a way which is not going to feel oppressive, and that's the goal. That's the Abrahamic kind of move, and that's allowing to provide an education, spiritual education for people who were denied that when they were growing up. Scenario number two: Stacy MG or is married, considering communities to live in. What would Yoshua Ben Gamel advise her? Yeah, think about the schools in the neighborhood. Yes, in other words, most people most people do think about schools. What do they think about? How good are the public schools? Like, I'm paying a lot of money in property taxes, and I want to get, I want to move to Jericho, Long Island, one of the top school districts in Great Neck North, whatever, in America. But if you want to have your child to be Jewishly connected and literate, the best, excluding, some exceptions, you need to outsource that into a day school. Now people say, well, instead, aren't you gonna, what about their secular? Are they going to top universities? One thing has happened the last 60 years in America. The modern Orthodox school system has proved conclusively throughout their teaching tens of thousands of students that you will sacrifice zero in your secular aspirations if you go to a day school. I was the Yeshiva High School principal. I sent students. Students went on to my school, to all the Ivy League schools. They didn't lack. In fact, just the opposite. The fact that they had spent their whole day doing a double curriculum, Judaic studies in the morning and general studies in the afternoon, with APs and extracurriculars, they did have to work a lot harder. So when they hit college, they were not overwhelmed by doing a 15 credit course load. Not a problem. We could do that. I work for JLIC. We have 26 campuses, secular campuses. I have rabbis on these campuses, and the kids they learn Torah as well, and they've all went to the day schools, and they're in the University of Pennsylvania, Cornell, Columbia, Yale, University of Chicago, Emory, University of Maryland, Binghamton, all those top schools, Harvard, of course. Yeah, so all the name brand schools. So if you want to talk about how to do this, the question is not, is it a good idea? The question is, Rabbi, that's very nice. How do I finance that? That's a separate conversation. I have some ideas on that as well. Okay, so we can talk about not tonight. We got some time. Okay, three. All right, last scenario of the night. Dan MGR, not this Dan MGR, is struggling with a relationship with his brothers and sisters. It always seems to end in a fight. What would Avram and Yoshua Ben Gamla suggest, allowing them to make better choices? Listen, okay. But it's more than just listen. Well, what does the person need? What is this Dan MG or not our Dan? What does this Dan MG need? Yeah, but it's too late now. He's now an adult. Let me pause like this. Do we know family members that when they speak to other family members that the conversation ends with one person slamming the phone down? Well, they don't have the benefit of them to slam the phone down, but dramatically turning off the phone. You don't get the good slamming that we used to have in the old days. In the old days, we had to just smack it down. Yeah, just smacking. Right.
Now it takes you like 3 attempts to find the button. It's even more embarrassing.
Right. I got to put it on. I got to get the code in. Gotta take that. National phones. Right. There's an app. Right. So what your Avraham Yehoshua Ben Gamliel suggest for this person? Yes. How's it? So why did he do it till now? He doesn't know that. That's kind of not fairly obvious. Right. See. So. Bottom line is, if a person is stuck in a dysfunctional relationship, they need to get the benefit of a therapist or a coach to learn the strategies to navigate that and to have a certain self-awareness. Like, why am I? Many people's relationship are basically what they call have the experience of Groundhog Day. It's like they're in a certain pattern. Person says A. This person says B. This person says C. This person says D. It's the same conversation with very little change, and the buttons, the emotional buttons, are pressed, and that's it. And the situation accelerates, and they're stuck. Mother-daughter relationships fraught with this. Very rare to have a high quality, non-complicated mother-daughter relationship. It's very hard. It does happen. It's not a relationship, which is hard. So that takes emotional education how to do that. Your mom cannot teach you about how to better deal with her mishigas. Okay, this is not getting. She can't do that because she is part of the problem. She herself has certain dysfunction, which she got from her mother. You know what I'm saying? There's an intrinsic problem of all the system. She cannot step out of herself. One strategy that a therapist will have you do, I'll just give you one little therapeutic move you can do, is to reframe your parent not as your mom or your dad or your brother or sister, but look at them as they are, an adult of a certain age. Imagine you're talking to an adult of a certain age. What would you say to them then? If you take out the identity of parent, sibling away, your ability to deal with them will be a lot less heavy and complicated because you're now going to deal with a person who is, then you become more empathetic and sympathetic. Yeah, this is a person who's struggling with this issue and that issue, and I understand what they're going through. And you can be more compassionate in your response because you understand that they're what they're going through, because you're not relating to them as you're stepping yourself out of the parent-child sibling dynamic. I'm talking to an adult, and I talk to adults at the workplace or in life, and I am able to navigate it much easier. It doesn't have the baggage of the relationship of the 30 plus years relationship, which is can be suffocating. You know what I'm saying? So basically, I'm going to sort of now in our last moments together. Just to summarize essentially the main concept. The main concept is now I'm going to sequence it. We started off class one of the reality of that man, as expressed in the first chapter of Bereishis, as a Tzel Melekim, which is a mind. And a feature of that is, we saw by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, you have the ability of free will. As the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, Jonathan, you have the ability to put yourself in that situation. You have the power to get yourself out of the situation. You are not a victim of your circumstance, our free will. Ah, but free will is not so simple. You need the Father, ultimately Avraham Avinu, a Father in heaven, in other words, who gave us the Torah, the first system to help, Avraham, and the other fathers, Yeshua ben Gamliel being the one that we focus on this week, who are create a paradigm which allow you to overcome the tremendous weight against the free will. Allow you to be able to have a free will. Can you get the education to be able to navigate life better, where you're not going to be victimized by circumstance? And that basically is the whole package. So we have soul, free will, the father, and the educational paradigm, which we now call the Torah, to liberate the person, to give a person the chance to do free will. That's basically the entire Torah standing on one foot. That's basically the whole package. Okay, is that clear? Okay, good. All right, guys, we will do this again next week. Stay tuned. You like that? Good. Questions? All right, last question. Yes. A private question? Okay, fine. We're gonna.
We can all.
Ooh. Okay, send them back.
It's a follow-up question.
Follow-up question. Go ahead.
So we said that a moral question is not necessarily a Torah question because, like, ancient debate as to whether or not Torah is the source of morality. But
well, a person could add, well, there was morality. Look, Abraham's pre-Torah, so he's doing moral choices.
Okay, right. So the point is, was he pre-Torah capable of Bechira?
Yes.
Okay.
Only him.
Oh.
No, not, I mean, only him and people like him, because he was able to intuit and figure out a well thought out ethical life beyond just following his instincts. Most people are not able to do that. In other words, I'll put it this way. If the world was composed of Avrams, you wouldn't need the Torah.
Well, no, I get that.
Because you would automatically be the Torah.
So I guess what I'm saying is, like, Avraham is the father as here of all mankind. But
yeah,
of course, there's the Abrahamic religions and traditions. But okay, there's parts of the world that extend beyond that. But presumably, there are people who have made morally heavy decisions with, would their decisions qualified as Bechira?
That's a super tough question. Theoretically, yes. And we have to go into some of the more detail. But what I'm trying to share with you is that I'm not dealing with, I want to point out that there are the exceptional spiritually elite people, an Avraham Avinu person, and then there's 99.999. That's what I'm essentially focusing upon. And Avraham taught his children and the people around him, and then Moshe ascended the world, and Yeshua ben Gamla on his level did that. And putting that all together allows a platform where a person has a chance at free will. I think free will is very hard. It's not simple. Because don't you feel the pull of just being pulled under by what you as a person wants to instinctually do? Yeah, everybody, every person. So this is what allows to strengthen the mind to be able to make there's an alternative. Basically, there's more. I mean, this is a mega topic. We're just in an hour together, just touching the topic here.
Beautiful.
You're beautiful. I like a beautiful class. Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Beautiful. Yeah.
Oh,
that
was
okay. Fine. Okay. All right. Eternally beautiful. Deeper than beautiful. Yes.
Pretty good for starting with Howard Stern.
Right.
I may also have something.
The lottery. You got to be in it to win it.